Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
What a weekend of college lacrosse. Nick, the birds are chirping, the sun is shining, the tulips are dying. We're that far into spring. You are actually watching college lacrosse today. We are recording bright and early because you have a real live tailgate to get to. What do you say, Coach Osello?
Terry, this is why we play the game. It's today, it's boots on the ground. It's Merrimack versus Albany. Conference stakes on the line. I'm at a Holiday Inn Express, and the Wi-Fi better hang on, or I'm going to have a serious talk with the mayor of Andover, Massachusetts. And you're right. People forget that with spring here very quickly, those tulips just die. So I hope you enjoyed them while you had them. Let's focus our attention maybe to the cherry blossoms, maybe to the hydrangeas, maybe to the future lilacs, perhaps one of my favorite smells in the entire world. And 4/21, conferences are clearing up, eyes on the playoffs, and some of the best lacrosse being played right now. Who has it better than us? Are you kidding me?
I just realized that on 4/20, we had the Patriot League, which had six teams tied for 4-2, at 4-2 for the standing in, or the league standings. We had that separate between Friday and Saturday. And now, if Merrimack beats UAlbany, which they're coming off of a game on Friday against Yale, interesting scheduling choice, seems like a realistic possibility as they go in 3.5 goal underdogs. The America East is going to have six teams tied atop it at 4-2, which is absolutely insane.
Nuts. And that was the talk of the parents. And there's only like three places you can go in Andover. So like we went, it was me, my girlfriend's family, and then another player's family that, you know, it's always funny to see like, ooh, what parents like each other, like who's going to hang out and agree as families.
I think the goalie parents and the D-Mitty parents tend not to get along.
No, face-off parents always get along, and they're just kind of the weird ones in the corner. That's where my family usually was like, hey, your son's a face-off guy, let's be weird in the corner. And then when I started playing midfielder, my parents
they booted
were like,
you out.
Yeah, you guys stay in the corner, we're upgrading. So great little parent dynamics. And that was the buzz, because there are only like three places to go to dinner, so we ran into half the team everywhere we went. And it was, the parents are acutely aware of the conference implications for the game today.
With all that being said, I hit the road on Friday in order to go to a game on Saturday. And I can start in two places. The first is, have you ever kind of made a plan for a trip and then wondered whether or not like all the effort was gonna pay off?
And heading into it, yes. And oftentimes that tees up where I think you're going, which is...
It was absolutely incredible and one of the most justified effort expenditures I have had in covering a lacrosse game during my entire career. And then the second place I want to start with this is, so how old are you again?
What? Really? That's how we're starting?
Yeah.
Ew, 31.
Because I want to
know,
and you're the oldest in your family, right?
No, I have an older sister.
Was she into college lacrosse, specifically like the early 2000s, late 90s Syracuse teams?
I would say actively avoided it. If there was anything she was avoiding at that time.
How would you characterize your familiarity or understanding of the notion of kind of the Syracuse aura and the way in which they would win games that they should lose all the time for like 25 or 30 years?
I would say,
particularly given that you were on the other end of it a few times, I'm sure.
Lack of understanding of what Syracuse was doing prior to about 2007, we'll call it.
Okay. Yeah, so let's dive in because that's the place we got to start.
And Syracuse, Virginia. And what's nice is we've talked several times on this podcast about what Syracuse is doing, their roster, what it's looked like the past couple years. And I feel like it accumulated all into one of the best games of the season. And it wasn't that, oh my God, the last, you know, it wasn't the Siena comeback. It wasn't anything like that. It was just fireworks from start to finish. And it was just one of those games where about 5 minutes into the game, you kind of recognize that it was going to be a true classic, and it's why we play the game. Paul Gait gets his number retired at halftime. Almost 9,000 people there on a day where UVA was wearing their throwback unis. I mean, it's almost tough to even break this game down because there's 15 different ways that you can go. But I feel like you tweeted out the runs in this game, and that's where we have to start. 6-goal run for Cuse in the first quarter. After that, UVA had 3 in a row. After that, Syracuse had 4 in a row. After that, UVA had 3 in a row. Syracuse scored, and then UVA had 4 in a row again. I don't even know how to have this be a part of a rundown because, you know, it's just I'm overstimulated.
It's the whole show.
Excited. It's the whole entire show. Another place that we need to talk about is the goaltending position. Will Mark is very good at stopping the ball, the second best in the country behind Leon Edelman. Matt Nunez has quite frankly been on a roller coaster, and he was he had a brutal start, 0-for-8. But he was able to get back on track, and credit to Virginia for keeping and you know their faith in him. What's wild about this game too, with 1:44 left, defender Billy Dwan, who has had a couple goals that have been jaw droppers this year, he's the guy that plays defense, pushes in transition, and then somehow is the guy that scoops up the garbage rebound and puts it in the back of the net with enough consistency to where it's almost making me scratch my head where I'm like, okay, so now there's a defender that we have to mark on those, you know, loose ball crease scrums. What is happening right now? Ultimately, it was Sammy English who scored with 48 seconds left, but it was a game littered with just quite frankly, unbelievable performances. Hiltz, Thompson, Leo, Stevens, Mule for Syracuse, Schellenberger, Millen, Cormier, Colsey for UVA. It was just an awesome slugfest, and I want to hear what it was like to be there.
You know, it was an interesting day in the sense that Carolina Notre Dame started at 11:30. I was interested in that game. Obviously, there were a bunch of games that started at noon and 1 o'clock as well. So I got to the Dome at like 11:15 just so that I could be set up and kind of taking everything in. And so over the course of the 2.5 hours before the, you know, opening faceoff, it just started to build and build and build. And by the time the game started, you know, it was interesting. Virginia got out to a little bit of a early lead. Peyton Cormier scored the first goal, and Connor Schellenberger had the second, I think. And you know, it was like, all right, because I think on paper Virginia was enough better that it could have been feasible that they could have essentially like built a 5-goal lead and kind of coasted the entire way. Didn't think that was a likely outcome, but it was possible. So then, you know, once Syracuse responded and threw that counterpunch, and a hard, heavy counterpunch that prompted Lars to call timeout. I think they were up 8-5, and it felt like the game was, you know, potentially going to get away from Virginia. They immediately score coming out of the timeout, and you could tell the Syracuse fans were like, "Aw, I thought that this was going to be a comfortable day at the office," and no, it was not. And, you know, your point is well taken in terms of the game of runs. When I tweeted that graphic, 5 runs had occurred. In totality, 6 runs ended up happening. Syracuse scored the last 4 goals of this game. And that's why, for me, when, you know, this starts, and the story of this game starts and ends in the same spot. Gary Gate started his opening game comments with it, you know, and it really does tie back to that whole DNA and why I framed a question to you that I did. Syracuse went during like kind of their era of dominance. So let's just call it from 1987, 88, 89, wherever it started through effectively 2004, Mike Paul's graduation. And then the legacy and lingering that included, you know, those 2008-9 teams, obviously 2009 against Cornell being the, you know, most substantial moment. But then even, you know, the 2013 team that made the run to the national championship game, like, those teams kind of and it did actually persist as well a few years later, you know, kind of up through the end of the John Desko era. When you played against Syracuse, there was this measure of belief that was reliant on their belief in their playmakers, or if not reliant on, I guess built on top of, just like other teams' scheme, you know, other teams' scout. Those are not things that Syracuse does. Syracuse just has, they instill their DNA in their players, and they believe that they are going to make plays down the stretch. And they've lost these close games, overtime to Maryland, overtime to Army, overtime to Cornell, right? That game went to overtime after the crazy allowed goal with 1 second left. And so, you know, that is an example of what Syracuse isn't, right? And so the whole story of this season, and if you go back and read my preseason column on the cover of Inside Lacrosse says back, the notion was that the talent was there last year. The knowledge of how to win was not, because they were young. They needed to learn how to win. What was interesting is that they imported a lot of guys who know how to win. Christian Millet won Patriot League championships and made it to the NCAA tournament. Sammy English and Jake Stevens made it to the Final Four. Even Matt Wright has won a lot of games when he was at North Carolina. They imported a core of guys who know how to win that were meant to meld with the talent that they had on the roster. And all season long, Gary Gate has talked about they just need to figure it out. They need to, you know, kind of have that last element. And when he and I spoke for that article in, I think it was late January, I asked him. And it's funny because, you know, there's because Inside Lacrosse is based in Baltimore and you know, I'm not from a lacrosse area, right? I think that, you know, we're definitely more associated with that than we are other places. The DNA, the Syracuse DNA at Inside Lacrosse is really strong. For the last, I guess at this point, like 11 or 12 years, I have had a coworker who was for a stretch of 7 years, Gary Gates' best player, right? So between Hallie Quillen and Alyssa Murray, I have every single day for 11 years talked to somebody who knew how Gary Gate coaches better than all but maybe two or three other people on the entire planet. And so simply through that, I felt qualified to be able to speak to what he has been trying to accomplish for the last 2 years. And the way that I describe it is he tries to basically take what's in his own brain that allowed him to be, if not the, then certainly one of the greatest players of all time, and just push it into the brains of all of his players. But it takes time. It's legitimately osmosis. And it doesn't just take time, because it also requires work, right? And he talked about it. He talked about how, you know, when we go out and play, you know, whomever, like, I visualize the entire game, whether it's winning faceoffs, whether it's getting stops, whether it's scoring goals, doesn't matter. And so the point is that, you know, for all of the implications of this game, and there are a lot, but there aren't actually that many because both these teams are going to be in the NCAA tournament. Really, the only implication is whether Virginia is at home or on the road, because they still need a couple quality wins in order to bolster their resume. They're 10-3 now. They have Notre Dame to finish the regular season, and then they've got two more shots at quality wins in the ACC tournament. So even then, like, they've got three shots at quality wins over the course of the next 2 weeks. Like, their NCAA tournament situation is far from, you know, resolved as the Syracuse's. So, like, this wasn't a game with a ton of implications. The most important implication is, can Syracuse viably compete for a national championship? And in order to do that, they need to be Syracuse, right? The DNA of Syracuse. And what they showed, both in terms of their counterpunch and in terms of this ridiculous element of the never say die, right? Like, they are zombies. They win games like this all the time over the course of the last 38 years. And it's unexplainable. And this is how. Billy Dwan having his... There were two long poles on the crease. Sam Alexo and Billy Dwan were standing hip to hip. I got the goal scorer wrong when I identified it, because there were two long poles next to each other. I was like, it's only, like, can you imagine Notre Dame? Can you imagine Notre Dame down one with a minute and a half to go, having two long poles on the crease for a loose ball scrum that lasted like 10 seconds?
I mean, Coach Corrigan would have pulled a gun. I mean, I don't even know what there would have been, the implications of that. And that's the scary part. I'll tell you one thing. As far as, like, you know, viewing it through a selfish lens of what does Notre Dame have to do to repeat, I'm like, I would like to avoid Virginia until the national championship potentially, but this
No,
game,
you can play them in the semifinals. It'll go out overtime, but you can play them in the semifinals.
I just want to be on the different side of the bracket from them, because, you know, every time we would be playing in the playoffs, I'm like, can we just play Duke in the Natty instead of losing to them earlier than that? And I feel like this Syracuse team, this is exactly what everybody else in the country did not want to see, was this, we're a family-friendly podcast, so I'll say this, screw it, we ball attitude, and the ability to execute on that, and the talent, and the depth, and the lack of ability to game plan against Syracuse, because how are they going to score? Well, we're not going to run a drill in practice against two long poles on the crease who are trying to score. Like, we don't even know how they're going to do it, because they don't. They just know that they're going to. And that actually becomes really entertaining, and I'm excited to see what Syracuse can do with it, because anytime you run into a team like that, as opposed to a team that's like, okay, here, we're going to dodge down the alley and then pass and then move it to the backside. And we'll talk about the most boring game and the most boring rivalry of the weekend here in a little bit. But this Syracuse team, I'm just telling you, watch every one of their games from here on moving out, because there's probably going to be a situation that will never be repeated, not only in this playoffs, but maybe not in the next 5 years to come.
I want to make one more point about this game and give Sammy English a shout out, because, you know, 2 years ago when Princeton was making its run to the Final Four, I think he was a 50-goal scorer. And to do that from the midfield, not easy. And he is a very special player who, you know, last year he was struggling shooting, and then his season ended early against Syracuse as a result of a spleen injury. So, you know, for him to have this opportunity to come to Syracuse, he's got an additional year, so he'll be back next season. But even then, like, you know, I don't think that he had had his moment yet this year. So the game-winning play, it starts with Luke Roa sweeping across the top. And I love crisscross action at the top. I love pass down, pick downs, you know, especially when you can see it coming on camera from like far away. So Roa leaves it off for English, and the way in which three Virginia defenders react to him, but he still manages to get topside. And you can see this kind of like the hedge and retreat action. And it was clear that there was miscommunication as to who was actually going to stay with him. So he gets to the middle of the field with the most time and room and the most goal to shoot at. And I thought Mikey Diggs made a really good comment of saying, like, this is the prototypical overthink it situation. And so to not only not succumb to the overthinking it situation, but to also drop it down and go low to low with the low bouncer, I mean, you know better than I do, Nick, like how much gall that takes, because if you get saved on a low to low, like your teammates are probably not good. It is way better to miss high than it is to get saved on a low to low. How much gall, how much courage did it take to shoot that shot?
I mean, the cojones, I don't know how he wheelbarrowed his cojones to get that much time and room. And they're the low to low and the low to high. Like, even if you shoot overhand, you can kind of be like, well, that's what coach says, and I'm just doing my job. To even have a low release point from there, and as far as the prototypical, like, overthink it situation, times 100. Because I have to imagine, if I'm in his shoes, and you are just kind of doing a generic sweep, and it's against Virginia, and it's late in the game, with that much room, I just would probably be thinking like, okay, am I getting back checked in like 1 second? Like, this isn't happening. This is not happening. So to step in, and there's one of two things. He either said, I'm here and I'm going to be the hero, or he was like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, and just relied on like,
I got to get this out of my stick.
There's always that, you know. I remember we had some pretty ridiculous goals. I'm like, dude, what were you thinking right there? And he was like, dude, I have no idea. I was just trying to get it out of my stick. I was so scared. I'm like, yeah, that kind of seemed more like it. But
I have a feeling we'll return to this game, but let's keep it moving. There's another big one that we got to talk about.
And, you know, honestly, quite frankly, I don't want to talk about this one because I almost fell asleep trying to cover it. So Hopkins, Maryland, a game that I was excited, you know, Hopkins ended up winning 7-5. So I'm going to be overly critical because coming from, you know, an 18-17 slugfest to go to a 7-5 snooze fest, it's just also kind of funny to dog on Hopkins and Maryland. This was the Brookdale Senior Living Bowl, put on an absolute duster for about 10,000 fans. And we talked last weekend, and I was like, yeah, this is kind of like the weekend where we're going to talk about crowds. I should have potentially saved that for this weekend because the pictures of Homewood packed, even like Arlotta had a line out the door for UNC, the UVA, Virginia, like there were some crowds where you take a picture, like sometimes you have to get that angle where it doesn't really show the empty seats and it kind of looks like the crowd. And I was like, no, this was drone shot city at Homewood. So here's a statistic. In the fourth quarter, with a rivalry game on the line, Maryland didn't get a shot off until under 6 minutes, and they didn't score in the last 23 minutes of the game. Literally, how does that even happen? Hopkins went up 3-0, and then heading into half, it was 6-3. You told me that Hopkins at 6-3 had already scored enough to secure the victory. I would have said, maybe I'm not watching this game. But they get the Maryland Crab Trophy, and Jealous and Degnan having two apiece. Daniel Kelly, the only multi-goal scorer for Maryland, and he had two. And, I mean, you got to give credit to Hopkins' defense and Maryland's defense and the goaltenders, and it was just a defensive slugfest.
And slugfest in the most real way possible, because yeah, there were 5 minutes of penalties in the first quarter, and the hit that Garrett Degnan, who plays offense, by the way, put on to, I believe it was B.J. Burleis, was
3 minutes.
So tone-setting. And that, you know, when you talk about not shooting, and it wasn't just the first part of the game, it was also in the last two offensive possessions as well, when, you know, there were basically short sticks deferring to a long stick coming down in transition, being like, you want to take the shot? Basically exactly what we were just talking about with Sammy English, except it actually manifested. And my question is, how much of that was a reflection of the physical tone that Hopkins set? And not only that, but also, I just want to call out the fact that this is something that we have already seen this season. If you remember, that was our main takeaway from Hopkins Loyola, was how physical Hopkins played. And they really just doubled down on it. And what's crazy is that, like, they, the ability to do it, not only with consistency, but in a way that actually manifests in the game itself, right? Like two things. The first is, I can understand how you want to win the fight of the rivalry game, but I also can understand how basically it's like, all right, we're going to win the fight in the first like 5 or 10 minutes, and then we're going to actually play lacrosse. But what's interesting is that it seems as if the way that Hopkins wins the fight, quote unquote, actually has a significant effect on how the game unfolds. And so I don't know if that's something that we're necessarily going to see again this year. Like last year, Hopkins wins in College Park. It's Pete Milliman's first win over Maryland. And you know, I don't want to say that there was a monkey on his back because it hadn't been that long. But at the same time, you know, they certainly had a bad taste in their mouth from having lost 22-7 on senior day the year prior. So they were able to rinse that. But then they were hosting the Big Ten tournament. They play Maryland 5 days later and they lose, and it just didn't really even seem like it mattered. They were already into the NCAA tournament. They had their sights set on, you know, bigger and better things. This year, I feel like we're going to get even more of that, in the sense that, you know, we in the Big Ten quarterfinals are set. It's a pair of rematches from games that happened this weekend, right? So we are seeing runbacks 7 days later.
Run it back, baby.
In a typical year, like, these games aren't even on television. Like, you have to get them on BTN Plus. So, like, the Big Ten quarterfinals really fly underneath the radar relative to the majority of the national scene in that second last weekend of the season. And then the Big Ten tournament is going to be in Columbus, which, you know, I'm not saying the games that happen in Columbus don't have big profile, but on a relative basis, you know, relative to being at Maryland or Hopkins, like, there aren't going to be as many people there. And so, you know, it's going to be just one of those things that happens. And especially if the, you know, semifinals, well, we certainly know that they are going to be Maryland and Hopkins, but as long as Penn State advances, then, you know, you basically are going to have three of the four teams already in the NCAA tournament. So the stakes are going to be pretty minimal there. And really all that comes down is whether or not there's going to be a bid thief and whether or not that fourth team is able to keep their season alive. So with all that being said, I guess my point is, like, I wonder if we've seen the end of Bully Hopkins trying to win the fight and then subsequently winning the game as a result. But it doesn't really matter, because they've shown they beat Virginia 17-15 in Charlottesville. Like this is a team that has shown the ability to win playing right-handed and left-handed. If right-handed is a physical rock fight and left-handed is a flashy goal scoring contest, they've shown the ability to win both these games against top five opponents. So no, that's an important thing to understand when it comes to who is Hopkins, how likely are they to not just make it to the quarterfinals, but get to the Final Four. Both those considerations are important. And then the last thing is Chase Erland. I mean, he finished at 66% at least. I don't know. I know he had 10 saves at one point, and he didn't let in a goal. I don't know whether or not he got it to 11 or 12. But I do know that he made a bunch of big saves down the stretch and prevented this from being potentially more dramatic than it otherwise was. So, you know, for a guy who – well, I looked at the top 15 goalie stats, save percentage leaders this week, and what stood out to me, typically I would say five. So a third of the top 15 ranked goalies by save percentage are in the power conferences, the ACC Big Ten, and then potentially the Ivy League as well. And for a generation, talking to goalies or hearing, you know, an analyst talk about why, the explanation is, well, the shooters are too good. So once you get into league play, it's impossible for those guys to sustain their save percentages. If you look at, well, I don't know if it's changed over the course of what happened this weekend, but if you looked at it on Thursday, I think like 10 of them were from the power conferences. And it was interesting for a number of reasons, not the least of which is because it speaks to the role that goalies are having with respect to actually determining the outcomes of games. You know, we're going to talk about Ohio State, Michigan momentarily. And one of the stories of Michigan season has been for the last 2 weeks, they've run into goalies that have made 19 saves, career highs, against them, right? And certainly you can look at it as an offensive player and say, you know, we didn't shoot to score to the extent that we needed to. And so as a result, the goalie had a career day. But on the other end of the spectrum, you know, if you're Hopkins and you're saying like, you know, here's a guy who we were really excited to bring in. He was familiar with our head coach. He had recruited him to Cornell. But at the same time, and he's like a borderline All-American player, but at the same time, he was under 50% each of his last five games last season. Like, what exactly are we going to get out of him? Like, I would argue that you have gotten more out of Chris Erland already this season than you could have reasonably expected. And so that's another important thing to keep in mind with Hopkins going forward.
I just love a good lazy explanation that's almost a bit. Like, why are goalies, you know, power 10? Wow, the shooters are good.
Yeah.
And then now I'm chalking it up where it's like shooters are bad these days.
Correct.
Like, you know how kids are. They just don't shoot good. But to go back to one of your points earlier about Hopkins, I think looking at the course of the season, this game certainly was just let's go have a fight and we'll probably win a lacrosse game afterwards. But to have that win over Virginia, they have the bookends, and they're almost, I would say, not the antithesis to Syracuse, just F it, we ball, but it almost seems like their win against Virginia and their win against Maryland, they almost had a little bit more calculation going into it, kind of going like, okay, here's kind of the tone that we're going to be setting, here's how it's going to play out, and here's how we're going to execute on it, so...
Well, specifically, they have an idea of how their opponent is going to bring to the table, right? And so, yeah. As a result, like they're like, all right, well, you know, we can't if we try to win a fight with Virginia in the first 5 minutes, like we're going to be down 5-0 because they'll have scored, you know, 4 extra man goals. So, like, that might not be – and not only that, but also, like, do we hate Virginia? Do we need to get into a fight with them relative to how much we hate
yes.
Loyola and Maryland? Well, you do. The last thing I want to say is, you know, all season, man, we've talked about Maryland's offense and we've talked about their lack of an alpha dodger and we've talked about how if they were going to score goals, they needed to be a ball movement facilitating team that found step down shooters. You know what punches a huge hole in that theory, that plan, that idea?
The crown of a helmet.
Having guys like not want to shoot the ball. It doesn't make any sense. Make it make sense, Nick.
No, and I refuse to, and I'm not going to because it doesn't make sense to me. You know, like it. At some point, someone just needs to be like, "I'm going to be the guy," and at least like, especially knowing that you are going to be playing in the tournament and everything like that. As you look towards the tail end of the season, it's a time to essentially the first half of the season you want to secure yourself as a pillar of the lineup, so you can't go out and experiment. Really. But I always used, and I know a lot of people, you know, that were in this same position kind of did the same thing. Or it's like, as we look towards the tail end of the season, and as we got into ACC play, and as we continued to develop as a team, it was kind of a sense of like, okay, now we can kind of throw some shit against the wall. If we're down 2 against Duke, if we're up, you know, 15 on Virginia, or whatever the situation would be, like, let's have guys kind of do things that might be out of their comfort zone, that might piss coach off, trying to be the guy, trying to do whatever it might be. And so for Maryland, I can't even tell you who, you know, what was different. Like, who wants to step up? and take a little bit of an experimentation role in a game that desperately needed it. So not only did they lose the game, but I feel like they didn't get anything out of the game either. And that's kind of a saving grace, where there would be games that we would lose, but we would talk as a team afterwards, not with coach in the room by any means, but we'd kind of just be like, okay, well, we found out that Sergio can shoot it from, you know, 19 yards, and we're okay with him taking that. Coach might not be, but we can at least have that in our back pocket. And Maryland got nothing in a loss to their rival, and they scored 5 goals.
And so we're to the point where logic, and I'll put it this way, it seems logical on the basis of 13 years of history to say a John Tillman coach team can figure it out. It also seems logical to say this Maryland team is who we thought they were, and to expect some of the past Maryland teams or some of the past John Tillman coaching performances to show up at this point and allow them to turn the corner and become more than what they probably were last year, right? Which is a potential first round exit, because they're going to have to play a really good team in the first round of the tournament, because they're going to be, if they get a home game, it's going to be in that 7-8 range, or there's a possibility they might be on the road against a 7 or 8 seed. You know, I guess that's the point, is that like that is the margin that we're looking at. And could they win that game? Absolutely. And then, you know, could they play their best game of the season in the quarterfinals? Of course. That availability, that outcome is available to pretty much every team in the top 15 right now. There's a difference between that and having a measure of certainty that we are a quarterfinal team. We are one of the best 8 teams, and we are going to get there. And then once you get there, all you need to do is win, and you're in the Final Four, right? That is what's so interesting about the way in which this season unfolds. I ran into Tucker Dordovic yesterday, and he's like, I can't believe it's already late April. And I was like, well, this is your first year not playing college lacrosse. And what you don't realize when you don't play is that January doesn't count. When you do play,
at all,
not only does January count, but it counts double because it sucks so much. It's so cold, and you don't get any of the rewards. Like, you're still scrimmaging, right? So you have like kind of normal game weeks for the last 2 weeks of the regular season of the month, right? But like it whatever. So you're just miserable by like the time the season actually starts. And so then you've got, you know, February is really like fresh and exciting, and then March is a little bit of like the doldrums, and then conference play starts and the weather starts to get nice. So things get exciting in April and they start to pick back up. When you play, it's a 5-month season. When you're a fan, it's a 4-month season. And so when you lop off 20% of it, or 25% of it, depending on which angle you're looking at it from,
lightning quick.
It's a lot, right? And not only that, we're also like on a volume of games played basis, we're probably like 85% of the way through. But on a duration basis, even if you look at February 1st as the start date, you know, we're still like in the middle of the third quarter. But what's crazy is that the margin of how we remember teams on a historical basis is really determined by 1 week in May. And I've said this all the time. Brett Queener taught me this. This is why he broke a stick over his leg when he lost to Cornell in the overtime of the quarterfinals. Because when you lose in the quarterfinals, you're pretty much just forgotten to history. When you win in the quarterfinals, you get to go to the Final Four. You get to go to the pinnacle, the game's biggest stage, right? And so that's why we always talk about, are they happy to be here? Because making it to the Final Four is an accomplishment in and of itself. And there are two types of teams to show up at the Final Four. Teams that wanted to get to the Final Four, and teams that know that getting to the Final Four is a stepping stone to their ultimate goal, which is winning a national championship.
If you miss it, is that a complete waste of a season, like you just said? And there is such, I can't even explain the difference in, if when we got to the quarterfinals, it was like, okay, we win this, and now we're in the season. And anything.
But it's 9 days!
And it's 9 days, and it happens like that. And you're just like, wow, all of this buildup, January being miserable, you know, you're playing and practicing in an indoor facility that's 100 degrees, and then you walk out into -8. And I'm like, coach, one of us might die, like, just given the shock value. All of that is beautifully stated to, in the snap of a fingers, who is carrying that confidence, who is just happy to be there. We'll see with Maryland.
Let's keep it rolling.
All right. The other game, rivalry game, and that's in severe quotations because I could talk smack about both these teams, but Michigan 13, the Ohio State University 12, And it was another game of runs, as every quarter was, quite frankly, a blowout by one team or the other. Michigan was up 4-1 after the first. Ohio State came back in the second. It was 6-5 at half. 13-7 at the end of the third quarter. 13-7, I guess, at the start of the fourth quarter with a couple minutes in.
Michigan.
But Ohio State, Michigan, and Ohio State scored the last five to make it 13-12. So going into the fourth quarter and about, you know, a couple minutes in, everybody was just, all right, this is Michigan's game. Ohio State kind of stinks. This is going to be a tap dance for them. So credit to Ohio State for rushing and coming back. Touching on a couple points that you were making, Justin Whitefelt, 18 of 29 on the faceoffs, and Hunter Taylor made 11 stops and had a pretty dang good performance. That lethal faceoff has a good day, goalie has a good day, is just so incredibly difficult to overcome. Ryan Cohen and Isaac Aronson, which I loved that name, with hat tricks. And then eight different goal scorers for Ohio State in the Big Ten tourney. You know, what was Maryland's, Jesus, Nick. What was Michigan's reward for beating Ohio State? Congrats. You get to play them again this time next week. You know, make it a double. So Big Ten tourney set. Michigan beats Ohio State. Group chats go wild. Everybody relax. We're going to see this same exact game next week.
Well, my group chat went wild as well, because I texted you after the Penn Princeton game was over, but before this, well, I guess it was after this game started, but before it was like decided, I was like, I'm 4-0, which means that RIP Michigan, because you're definitely going to lose. Because if you've been listening to this podcast for the last month, I start 4-0 in my staff picks, and then I lose the last game. And it's happened. It didn't just happen for 3 weeks in a row, but then last week, because there were so many good games, we doubled it up, and I went 8-2. So the idea that Michigan was going to win was just so contradictory to the fate that I had laid out. And so that once this game started, I knew that you weren't watching. So once this Ohio State run started to happen, and they cut it to 1 and had the ball inside of the last minute, I was like, this is unbelievable. I mean, the fact that this is going to happen again is just because it started with the Princeton Cornell game. Cornell won on a long pole goal after Princeton came out of the timeout with the ball in a position to win the game. I mean, it was just so mind boggling. But in any case, a couple things about this. So Isaac Aronson, incredible, you know, kind of in the history of Michigan lacrosse, the lore, so to speak, a good game against Ohio State is definitely important for your legacy. And now you get to add that to your legacy. So really, really nice job out of him. Ryan Cohen is already a Buckeye killer. You know, so he didn't need another pelt on his wall, as it were. Hunter Taylor, yeah, 11 saves. That doesn't matter. The biggest play he made was with the clock winding down with like 20 seconds left. He comes out of the crease, makes one of the most aggressive, like, are you seriously going to go after that loose ball in the middle of a scrum, kind of low righty corner? Like, you know, there's goalies come in every shape and size, literally, and some of them you feel more confident in terms of what they look like in the open field, elusiveness-wise, but stick handling wise, we're going to talk about one guy that I think everybody feels very confident when he's got the ball in the open field. Hunter Taylor, probably like right down the middle. You know, not necessarily like your kind of early 2000s, 250-pound, I call them big fat lefties, that if they get the ball in open space, you're really concerned. Maybe even his opposite number, we should in that game, who also played really, I don't know, interestingly, right? Like had stretches where he couldn't save anything, and then had stretches. I'm talking about Alaric Fock, Caleb Fock, Big Tasty, where he played really well. But Hunter Taylor carries the ball into the offensive zone, and then my favorite part, Nick, if you're a goalie and there's like 20 seconds left and your team has a timeout and you're running towards your box and you're going to make it there without the ball getting dislodged, what are you going to do? Like, what would be your move?
If I'm the goalie,
yeah.
I mean, just toe drag after toe drag after toe drag. You have the goalie stick, you have the pocket. Let me just do that 100 times.
So my move is to run into the restraining box in order to allow my coach to call the timeout. Hunter Taylor's move was to throw the ball about a yard and a half above the restraining line. And I was just like, this is, I mean, if it doesn't get caught, they can't call the timeout. And then he's 70 yards away from the goal. Ohio State comes with a ground ball. There's 20 seconds left on the clock. Like, this is disaster It's just as big of a disaster as it would have been if he hadn't gotten the ground ball in the first place. It was an absolutely insane sequence that punctuated a really impressive run out of Ohio State in order to cut that game to one. And it really came from it was a different type of belief, I think, from what we talked about with Syracuse. It was a kind of lost this game already. Like, let's just go down with our hair on fire. And that's what it was. And then it kind of just, you know, it got to 13-9 and then 13-10. And then 13-11. And then Connor Camille picks up a ball off the wing. I mean, what it really was Justin Weifelt was awesome throughout the entirety of the game. And then I think Ohio State won, you know, maybe four of the last six, something like that. And really those last two that set up those last two goals, like that is when you could tell, like the belief started to turn and the prospect of Ohio State actually winning this game manifested. As far as what it means for Penn State to beat Rutgers, I think it was 11-6 on Friday night. And then Michigan to have won this game. And now, we see both those games in the opposite venues. We've seen this already in the Big Ten tournament in years past. And for Michigan, you know, for those that were disappointed in the way in which their first, I think it was 12 games, they were 6-6, I think, coming into this one, unfolded. It was exactly the way last year unfolded. Everything about the way that this season unfolded, down to the regular season win over Maryland and the subsequent losses afterwards, setting up a pivotal game against Ohio State, setting up a rematch in the Big Ten quarterfinals against Ohio State, is exactly the same as how last year unfolded, which means that everything that was available to Michigan in their best season in program history is available again this year. They're going to end up, you know, if they beat Ohio State in advancing to the Big Ten semifinals, they're going to end up playing a team that they're going to be underdogs against, and that if they beat them, they're going to have a quality win on their resume. And then if they beat them, they're going to end up playing for an opportunity to win an AQ, and they're going to be playing against a team that more likely than not doesn't care about the game. So, like, with the exception of obviously wanting to win a Big Ten championship for whatever that means, it's right there in front of them. And not only is it right there in front of them, that means that it's also right there for Ohio State and Rutgers as well, because Michigan gave the blueprint for how to do it last year. And so I said that the Big Ten quarterfinals are going to fly underneath the radar, and they probably will, but it'll be important to note who wins, because there's one team, presuming the Penn State wins, and, you know, obviously if they don't, then obviously this shakes us up. But if they do, but either way, we're going to have at least one team, at least Ohio State or Michigan, and potentially two, one of those two in Rutgers, that are in that position to do what Michigan did last year.
And I'm so curious. I just want to ask Ohio State and Rutgers players, like, hey, are you saying, hey, Michigan did it last year, we can do it this year? Or do you hate Michigan so much that you're not even ever comparing yourself against them? So, going to be awesome. I hope Michigan just does the same thing. You can just copy and paste the articles from last year and repost them, and it'd save you a lot of time.
I wrote a bunch of them, and they're good articles. So, yeah, I might actually do that. I hope Justin Brown scores three goals against Penn State in the semifinals again. That would make it awesome.
That would be a very interesting turn of events. Princeton and Penn. You just gave a great rundown of kind of a crazy play from a goalie. We can talk about anything, but the literal only thing that matters in this game is Michael Spicy Meatball Gianfricaro scoring. And you might be thinking, oh, is that the midfielder that scored? No, that's the goalie, you dingus. That's the goalie that was sprinting in a clear 13-10 at the time. So it was still a game that, you know, Penn could have came back sprinting. Shovel shot on the run, cherry on top. We talk about cojones. We talk about the gall, the cockiness, the who do you think you are, I am. One of the more ridiculous shots that I've ever seen from a goalie, because it wasn't like there was nobody that picked him up and he just tap danced his way and shot point blank from the crease. He was cutting across the middle, didn't even really have his momentum going towards the goal, and just throws a shovel shot. So after that, nothing matters. But, and he had 15 saves, 5 different 2-goal scores for Princeton. Penn had hat tricks from Provost and Skane. But Gianfricaro.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit in the sense of who do you think you are. I mean, this is who he is, and this is who he's been. I mean, he did this against McDonough when he was at Culver like 7 years ago. I mean, Mike is one of those players who, you're like, you're too athletic to be a goalie. Like, why are you a goalie? One of my high school teammates was like this. You know, he was one of the, like, you know, kind of, he was a little bit too small to play linebacker, a little bit too big to be a safety. And, you know, so as a result, he was just like one of the best players. Like, he's Kyle Hamilton, right? Like, it's one of the
ATH.
Yeah, he's one athlete. Correct. Monster is typically what they're called if you're playing a 3-5, 3-3-5. And that's legitimately what Mike was. He was a defensive back. I mean, he's too good of an athlete to be playing goalie. But that's why he's a good goalie. And that's why he can clear the ball really confidently, getting over the midline and having the stick protection to be able to move it on, to somebody who's supposed to have the ball in their stick, I guess is what I would say. But in instances in which that doesn't avail itself, or in instances in which he feels confident that he's going to be able to get to the dirt and deliver a goal-scoring chance, he'll take it. And yeah, I mean, he's a really good player. He is in the transfer portal. And, you know, we talked about Chase Erlin and what Johns Hopkins has gotten out of him so far this season. I think we're going to talk about a North Carolina team that I think is pretty similar to Syracuse last year. You know, that could be in a position to augment what they have in terms of the talent on their roster, with some inbound transfers. Yeah, that would be an interesting fit. It's getting to the point in the season when it's time to start asking where some of these 21 Ivy League seniors that are in the transfer portal are going to end up matriculating for the 2025 season.
Well, and that's the difference between you and I. Like, you have that foresight, and I am literally just like, there are going to be more fun games next week, and that's the only thing that matters. So might be the reason why you're, you know, a successful CEO and I'm just having a great time in Boston. So and the who do you think you are for GM for Carl, it was more in theory about who do you think you are in relative to the goalie position. How can you just be doing that stuff?
No, for sure. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm saying that, like, that's...
You kind of are saying that I'm wrong.
You're right. I actually literally did say, I'm going to disagree with you. So you're not wrong about that. You are wrong about...
All right. Moving on to the next segment, streak talk.
We're going streaking.
Alert. We're going streaking. I'm actually going streaking if Merrimack wins, and I will be in a Boston jail cell.
Andover.
So... Well, it depends on what, you know. Hey, if we make it to downtown Boston, if I run that far.
Freedom Trail.
I'm reading War on the Run with Robert Rogers, and now I'm getting into it. And that happened in this area. Very cool stuff. Everybody read that book. Loyola on the upswing. They beat Navy 12-10. And while this game was certainly a game, I'm bringing it up more so because Loyola is now on that 5-game win streak. On the down streak, Boston loses to Lehigh and now have lost 4 of their last 5. So, Terry, I'll just kind of propose that and throw that out there. Loyola on the upswing, Boston on the downswing. Reasonings, impacts, what do you got?
Well, so I think schedule plays a large part of it. And I think that that's an important thing not to overreact to. That being said, you know, we'll know a lot more about Loyola after this Army game. You know, that has been kind of the rubber meets the road game. Loyola has lost to Navy in recent years, but at the same time, like, when you look at kind of where both teams are, where both teams were coming off of their prior week, et cetera, et cetera, I felt like, I mean, this was a game that I was pretty confident Loyola was going to win in a manner in which was very similar to how they won it. So I'm not surprised on the basis of how the game unfolded. I do think that we can't talk about it without shouting out Adam Poitra because, you know, he's a Canadian lefty. And ultimately, the simple fact is that he's been playing on a position for the last 2 years because Loyola needed him to. It would have been, I think that the optimal composition of Loyola's roster and the way in which they would have been able to best take advantage of him would be to utilize him the way that Princeton last year, the last two years, and Syracuse this year has utilized Jake Stevens because that is what his skill set is. Here's a lefty attackman who ran the wing of faceoffs and led his team in ground balls, picking up 8, right? Like, that is a prototypical Canadian indoor player who can play at both ends of the floor, probably was a transition guy and just knows how to score, right? Like, Alex Marinier ended up being, I think, Ohio State's leading scorer. He was recruited as a defenseman, right? And it's just a reflection of the fact that, like, if you play lacrosse in Canada, just regardless of what position you play in field lacrosse, you know how to put the ball past a marshmallow man on a 20-square-foot goal as opposed to a 36-square-foot goal. It's a very valuable skill set to have. And with that being said, I think it would be foolish to overreact even to this win from the standpoint of Loyola. On the other end, I do think that if they get the win over Army and carry a 6-game win streak into the what would be the Patriot League semifinals, and I assume that they would be hosting, that is the recipe for a Loyola team to win the Patriot League automatic qualifier, which is a terrible recipe for the rest of the league because A, we're looking squarely at a one-bid league. B, we're looking at a Loyola team that has disproportionately dominated this league over the course of the last 10 years, even if that dominance has waned in the last two. And then C, Army, a team that has beaten North Carolina and Syracuse, would be like all of the way out of the NCAA tournament conversation. So just kind of crazy different machinations in terms of what the stakes are. As far as BU is concerned, obviously that win over Army in the middle of the year was kind of the pinnacle, right? Like they knocked off the number one team in the country. But if you remember, we talked about in the earliest podcast this season, I think they opened their year with Bryant, Vermont, two other games that were kind of in that ilk. And I remember saying at the time, you know, I could see them going 4-0, 0-4, and I would expect them to go 2-2. They emerged 3-1, right? And then so that set up what was a good early part of their season. The point I'm trying to make is this is a good team, and I wrote about it in my top 20 this past weekend. It would be foolish to overreact to those what at the time were the three losses in the prior four games. But they're also they're not perfect. They're not even great. They have flaws. And I think the flaws manifested, and specifically the flaw that manifested against Lehigh was, you know, that kind of close defense down the stretch and the way in which they played the pick at X in order to allow Scott Cole to get topside with his hands free to tie the game. It was a reflection of a settled defensive unit that just isn't quite as dialed or isn't quite as locked in, you know, as they're able to make plays in space. And that's just kind of the identity of who they are, right? Whereas at the other end of the field, you know, they for the last 3-4 years, because they're so slick, so talented offensively, have been one of the best teams in settled offense. It's an interesting kind of juxtaposition in terms of end of the field relative to the type of game they want to play, how they want to decide pace-wise, and then ultimately how you steal games, right? Because if you can't play slow possessions defensively, like, it does make it difficult in order to just prevent comebacks, prevent runs, especially if you're not dominating faceoffs. So, you know, ultimately, we have a little bit of stratification in the Patriot League, right? We've got three teams that are 5-2, three that are 4-3. It could completely flip back the other way in the last week of the regular season. So, like, it's too early to overreact to anything. It actually can't because we got two teams that are 5-2 and Army and Loyola playing each other. But that being said, you know, you could see some of that separation and stratification re-solidify, recalcify. So, again, overreacting, advise against it.
And so the next game that we'll talk about, this one's interesting because we haven't talked about them really all year. Jacksonville beats Air Force 10-9. And kind of going off of that streak that we were just talking about, Air Force had won 7 in a row. And to your point earlier, I feel like a lot of that was based around the fact that they had a harder schedule earlier. And in the ASUN, you can kind of stack a couple wins if you're a halfway decent program. So Air Force had won 7 in a row, but they beat Utah in that streak, and we haven't talked about them. And, you know, really, it starts with Air Force in about 2017 when I was there, so credit to me for doing and laying the groundwork. And then also credit to me for leaving and letting a guy like Will Corrigan come in and almost make a wish his way into the Air Force coaching staff. So that was one of the most charitable things that I've ever done in my life. Will, when you listen to this, fight me. If you're listening, Will and I are best friends. I love him and I'm very excited, but we haven't really talked about ASUN or Jacksonville. And as it related to this game, it was Air Force went into the fourth quarter up 7-4. And I had really thought that that was, you know, the nail in the coffin, because not only did they have a 3-goal lead in a game where goals were hard to come by, but it was a classic, cold, tough Colorado winter. And are we going to have a beautiful day, or is it going to be kind of flurrying, blustering, sleeting, and an absolute disaster? And it was definitely the latter of the two. So snowy, foggy, dusty day. Jacksonville is obviously in Florida. So for them to come back, have a 5-goal fourth quarter, or 6-goal fourth quarter, pardon me, at elevation in the cold. Huge resilience shown. And Jacob Greiner had three for Jacksonville, Turner Ashby and Hunter Panzik with two apiece for Air Force. I'll also give a shout-out to Josh Yago, Wheat Ridge kid. Wheat Ridge, the tough Wheat Ridge grit, Terry, as he's been a staple. But we also haven't talked about the A-Sun. You got Jacksonville, Utah, Bellarmine, and Air Force. What do you got?
Yeah, well, first I want to start by giving a shout-out to Detroit Titans and their head coach, Chris Cullen, who got a win over Bellarmine on Saturday. A ton of emotion in that win, and that was one of the, you know, it's sports, right? That's kind of one of the ones that you love to see. But that being said, I've got this from Kevin Brown, who put this into our company Slack at 11:15 last night. So not to say that we love ball more than you, but if you're not rewatching the Jacksonville Air Force finish and then sharing it with your colleagues at 11:15 on a Saturday night, then you don't love ball as much as Kevin Brown. Listen to this. He goes, pretty wild ending in OT. Yago makes his man fall, nearly trips himself, swims past the slide, almost gets a shot off. Tucker Garrity takes it the other way. Jackson and Cherry buries it. Air Force color guy devastated. Yago sets up Tolan, who has an OT winner to his name earlier this season, wide open from the wing, goes wide right. Griner got a chance to tie it with 3 seconds left right on the doorstep, but Merrick stuffs him, makes his 19th save, and he gets decked. Air Force faceoff win, and Drake's chance to win it right in front and turns agonizingly wide. Really easy Della Rocco save and gets hit late on a clearing pass. Super unnecessary foul to give away. It wasn't like an outlet to start a break. And boom, didn't even matter. Flag down. Anthony Caputo stepped down hammer. So, yeah, just one of those, you know, a fun games that matters a lot and is what lacrosse is all about. So, and for Jacksonville, a team that, you know, obviously has... They're kind of one of the darlings of the sport because of what they've done over the course of the last several years, particularly with their early season upsets. And then obviously in 2019, you know, having put together such a good season and kind of falling short of the NCAA tournament. I think it was 2019, but it might have been, I mean, I think it happened in 21 as well. So this hasn't been the last several have been for John Galloway's team. And so, you know, an important win for them, like you said, in tough circumstances at elevation and, you know, kind of with that A-Sun tournament right around the corner.
And to wrap it up, really, I didn't even put Notre Dame UNC on the rundown. Notre Dame spanks them. The only cool thing that I saw from that was the line out the door going and wrapping around the soccer stadium that's adjacent, reinforcing that point that I made earlier that maybe pulled the trigger a little too early last weekend talking about how there were awesome crowds because this weekend topped last weekend's. So if you've attended a college lacrosse game, good for you. And I get to make my mark, Albany Merrimack, this afternoon. And what's funny too is I was kind of I was going around and getting the parents riled up. They were like, "Yeah, Nick, you know, what do you think of this game?" And I'm like, "I haven't watched a second of either team all season."
You're such an asshole.
But I didn't tell them that. I was like, "Yale put together the blueprint to beat Albany a couple days ago. We now know how to beat Pacino, and turns out all you need is a generationally good lacrosse."
Matt Brandau is so good. And like, you know, Yale is 11-2 now. And they don't have their two starting attackmen in, like, their second best middie. And it's time for us to talk about, like, if you were to take those two players off of, like, every other top 10 or top 15 team, how bad would they be? Like, the fact that Yale is this good, they just games in 13 days without their two starting attackmen and their best midfielder, right? Or second best midfield, whatever the case may be. Yeah, Yale, really good. And fun one against Princeton. That's going to be awesome. But we'll see. I'm excited for you, man. It's the only game. It's the only men's Division I game today, and you get to go to it. So soak it up. Literally. Literally and...
soak it up. Yeah. And just so everybody knows how low I set the bar for myself last year, I came... and visited Merrimack, and it was Merrimack, I think it was Mount St. Mary's. I don't even remember. But it was my first time meeting a lot of my girlfriends, like, oh, yeah, like, everybody's here and this and that. And apparently they had come up with this scheme where they were like, okay, let's all do a shot with Nick, but let's do it individually and just get him tanked. So I fell asleep in the bed of the pickup truck in the parking lot at the last tailgate. And so going into it...
Pre-game?
I I don't know, Terry. I don't know when it happened. So it was such a bad performance that, like, I stopped drinking for, like, 3 months after that. And I was like, I need to check to see if I have a problem. I just need to go cold turkey and just not even associate with it. So this time last year, I was rethinking my life because I had such a bad performance. So what an opportunity for Merrimack to beat Albany, for me to bounce back and prove to all the adults that I am an adult and I'm not a liability anymore. And, you know, might even throw some tweets out there and say, hey, if you like the tailgate, you should be at this one. So what a day. What a time.
Enjoy it. Make sure you get a good base down. I recommend a bacon, egg, and cheese. Hope you didn't work out this morning. Those two things, not eating and exercising, are like the death knell for a pre-tailgate decision. So, yeah, we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, Terry, I can assure you I did not work out this morning. And final thoughts, Dom just brought me some breakfast.
There you go. She knows how important it is for you to get a base down.
Look at that. Yeah, because I think she's worried that I'm going to act like a complete idiot this
time. Yeah, like you did last time.
So, Terry, love you. What a day. Let's go have some fun.
Love you more, Nick. Love you more, Dom. Love you more. Mac Warriors, go get them, baby.
Dom, Terry said that he loves you.
I love him.
Okay, easy. She said she loves you, too. It's just a great day.